Hello, heroes, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. Heroes, by the time you listen to this, I will be at Dreamation 2016. Dreamation is an awesome con full of board games and card games and I think video games, and of course, all the LARP and tabletop you can handle. It's a lovely community. I really, really enjoy it. So if you're there, come say hi. And if you're not, just enjoy this episode with tabletop game designer Laura Simpson. Laura and I talked about her upcoming game, Companion's Tale, which you should be very excited about, and you may have heard an actual play of on One Shot. We also talked about her personal history with role-playing games, and some of what she's learned as a first-time designer. Laura shared a lot of wisdom with me, and I think you're going to enjoy it. All right, well, here we are chatting with Laura Simpson. Laura Simpson, say hi.
Hello.
Before we jump into talking about Companion's Tale, I'd really like to get to know you a bit better. What was your introduction to role-playing?
Sure. Okay, so in general, I gamed since I was like five or so. You know, you get the Atari and you're sitting in the basement. But actual role-playing games, I would say my entry into that was through Mushes and Muds and... Like, it was electronic. It wasn't really playing with other people, but, like, so it was the 90s. Everyone had, like, amazing clothing, amazing hair. And
So I missed out, unfortunately, on that, like, whole era of role-playing, which I'm super bummed about because it sounds like it was really formative for a lot of people. So these were, like, sort of like MMOs with no graphics, like text-based MMOs, basically. I don't know. What was going on?
Well... Okay, so there was a little bit of ASCII art, but most of it was you had to have the best description. So, like, the first one I took really seriously was a World of Darkness one, and that's what launched me into getting, like, an actual game text and reading it and really wanting to play. But before that, it was you're writing descriptions of yourself, you're writing every single movement that you do, and you're posing, like, pose. Laura languidly moves her hands, and just kind of her entire body moves as she tries to describe what it's like talking to someone on Mush. So your typing had to be, you had to bring your A game for typing, and you had to be really creative and really just like a great writer. You couldn't just write any type of description. It wasn't like Laura Simpson, she's like a 30-something, like short black lady with curly hair. No, you have to, like, describe everything. You describe, like, the color of your eyes and whether they're sparkling or not, like, the type of hair, how long it is it shiny, is it not, like, does it give a whiff of mystery, if hair can give a whiff of mystery, right? Like,
oh, totally.
Like, you would describe yourself down to your toenails, if you could, and when I was, like, an awkward teenager, right, and it was easier to talk to people through a screen than, like, in person, or at least, like, to roleplay with them. And, like, we would write descriptions for each other, and everyone was, like, by comparison, tabletop playing is much faster, because when you're playing digitally and you're writing all these descriptions, you're spending all this time editing and going back and forth to make sure what you're saying is amazing, and... Every interaction was important. It was the polite thing was if you were going to enter a room, like so basically it was like entering kind of like a space, like it's like a bunch of linked rooms, kind of like NetHack or something. So you'd read the room description, you'd try to interact with parts of the room, but also you'd write this long description of yourself entering so that you give someone something to play off of. It was just the polite thing to do. That was an interesting entry, and I started doing that when I was like 14, and I kind of stopped mostly when I got to college. Well, I stopped that type of role-playing. I went to a women's college, so I was at Smith. Everyone's really smart and geeky, so the sci-fi club is extra geeky about all things sci-fi. And at that time, there were a lot of really great gamers, people who... weren't afraid to try out new types of games. We were all enthusiastic. And some of my first GMs were like women that I'm still in touch with today. My friend Marguerite introduced me to Changeling. I was already into Vampire. And I spent so many Saturday nights in a LARP not doing anything and drinking coffee and wearing all black.
Vampire LARP.
Yes. I think some other people had more success, but that was kind of every 2 weeks. That was me. And it was awkward because you'd run into people from the college because you're in the college town. So that was kind of fun. But I did a lot more tabletop, and we branched out. Like, some of us were really interested in playing with different, we're really into the story, we're into the lore, and often we would do kind of like a little bit more subversive things when we brought that into games like D&D. One of my friends at the time, Katie, she was so obsessed with Dungeons and Dragons and Planescape Torrent. And the thing about it was, she was really into setting up these elaborate battles, and the rest of us just weren't into it like that. And we wanted to play with her, right? And we're trying to be supportive. We wanted to play D&D, but I think what we really wanted to play was like Dungeon World or something.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no Dungeon World. It was like, this is like 2001, 2002. Like, this,
right.
we're basically just kind of saying, well, but we wanted to see what it means to travel as a group and our interpersonal drama. And I want to play a drow who wants more out of life than to be like chaotic evil or whatever, or lawful evil. And that was kind of that was really interesting, and it was hard to leave. I think the first game I consider an indie game that I played was Besom. So it's Big Eyes, Small Mouth. It's like you emulate anime.
Oh yeah, the anime one. Yeah, I've never played it, but I have heard of it.
It was really fun. It's like rules light, so you can really kind of bend it to what you want it to do. And I had a GM, Cassie. She was a first year who came in just knowing like games. Like she's run a ton of games, and we just plowed through this Final Fantasy-esque alternate world type of game session. And it was kind of amazing because there was interpersonal relationships, and rolling was important. So it's not like we wanted to abandon number crunching or anything like that. But it was just wanted something that was balanced in between the two. Because, I mean, even now, I play Pathfinder occasionally, or whichever generation of D&D is out. And I have a very different mode of play than when we were playing Besom or trying to figure out mysteries as mages or vampires. I had an unhealthy obsession with mage. Like, White Wolf has taken so much of my money from younger, dopier Laura. So much money. And it was after all that, I had a huge hiatus. After I graduated college, I was in Western Mass for a summer, and then I wound up in Florida when my parents retired. And oh my God.
Mm.
It's not like there wasn't gaming. I mean, there was gaming, and I knew people who gamed, but I totally missed out on tabletop gaming. I did mostly solo play. Like, I have a ton of PS2 RPGs that I swore I was going to play. I wound up just collecting them. They're still sitting on my shelf. I still haven't finished them. But I played, I'd play like 20, 25 hours on each one. And I'd get really close to the end, and then just kind of, my attention was fragmented.
I've never been a completionist either. I totally hear you.
Like, sometimes you can be satisfied just playing. And at the same time, I was doing a second degree. I was in art school, because like you're in Florida, so you need to do something for yourself. And when I was there, I thought about, well, why don't I just make a game? I play these games all the time, so I made this card game. It's ill-fated, but I feel like I should mention it. It's a card game about trying to graduate art school on time. And you had to balance things like you had to, pay for your credits. You had to make art. And you had to accumulate a certain... So if you accumulate enough credits, you would win. Now, if I was remaking it, I would totally try and balance it as a commentary on higher education.
Second edition,
yes. it went over like a lead balloon with the other art people, but
not a receptive audience. That's a bummer.
I think that if I went about doing it again, it would be so much better. Now I know a lot more about game design, but it was kind of like a fun attempt, and I just kind of like, I boxed it. It's sitting in my parents' house right now, and I didn't really I played WoW with people. Like, it was all digital for like a while, like 5 years or so of just playing digital games. But when I left, because you like leaving Florida, you have to understand, is like, it's like it's kind of like harnessing a force of nature, because it's a type of place that it's easy for you to ease into just staying there. And you don't think about it too hard. Maybe you'll say, I want to go, but then you stay. So, like, I feel like I attached myself to a rocket ship and, like, went to Montreal. So, I kind of,
awesome.
Like, extremes, you know? Just, like,
yeah,
from Florida to Montreal.
Montreal's a great place to be an artist.
It is. It really is. I was a grad student at Concordia. And I, you know, was doing the art thing. It's fun. The art thing doesn't really, like... It can pay well, but it doesn't pay well for most people. And mm-hmm. in the end, I wanted to, I don't know, like, make money. So I wound up coming back to New York and where I am now, like, to go to, like, to switch grad programs mm-hmm. from fine arts to design technology. Because, you know, you can, a lot of the skills are transferable. But more importantly, it's kind of around that time I got exposed to more indie games, or what I consider indie games. And realize that there's more to it than making a game where you're trying to balance a system of, I guess, art credits versus monetary. Like,
right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So around that time, I started dating Dev Parkasa. Like, full disclosure, I married him. Just saying.
Spoiler alert.
So via him, I met a ton of indie game designers, and I got to actually play all these indie games, and he wrote one right around the time we started dating, and I was reading it, I'm like, oh, so this is really different. This is different than the type of games I was playing. For his game, Dance of the Dawn, you use chess pieces, and it's about ladies trying to find true love, and it's totally different than anything I was playing at this point in time.
What were some other games that you were getting into at that time, that sort of revival for you?
Man, so this is like around 2009. So I came back and I started, oh gosh, I don't want to get the timeline wrong, but I'll risk it. I think one of the first games that I remember playing around that time, I played It's Complicated with Elizabeth Shoemaker, who's now Elizabeth Sampat, and it was different. And I'm still like of the mindset like of gaming where you have dice and systems, and if there's a threat, you need to identify it and attack it. And it was a game where it's like, no, this is not about that. This is about setting scenes. Like, I think it was the first time I ever framed a scene or understanding like what it was, like, what type of boundaries you'd set. So I played that one, and then I played Breaking the Ice with Dev P.
Oh, that's a beautiful, beautiful game.
Yeah, it was fun, and it was really a kind of, at that point, I just became really, really interested in, okay, what else is there we could play? What else is there that is available? Like, I kept playing board games off and on, because in college, we played a fair amount of board games.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you have like a really, really broad palette in terms of games. Like, I've heard you reference like really like World of Darkness-y kind of style role-playing games. Sounds like you did some vampire LARPing in there, which is interesting. But then also like video games and board games. And did you design a board game at one point?
I did. Oh my God. So I made a game called Kobold Engineer, and it was, not only like, so this is a lot more, the first time I wrote it, there was a game chef. It was the one that involved going into Threads of the Forge. So it was a while ago. And I was trying to put something together. It was very light. Everyone was so kind when they said it's light, because I was just kind of trying to figure out how it goes. And I thought, why don't I try and do this at Manitopia? And I was really encouraged, like, because via Dev, I got to meet a lot of people, like Elizabeth and Shreya Sampad, who both had written games, Emily Carabas, Meg Baker, Vincent Baker, and Julia Embo. And I just got to meet people who were doing things. It's not like I was necessarily playing games with them at the time. It was just more of like, later on when I would read through things, I'm like, oh, this person made that. I should give this a read. So it's kind of, a transitional time where, you know, you meet people and you're like, oh, it's nice to meet you, person. And then later on, you're reading something like, oh, this person I met wrote this, and this is really fantastic and fun. I made this game, Kobold Engineer, and I brought it. And it's the idea is that they're kobolds, and I felt like kobolds are, you know, they're kind of treated badly. I've actually played in a D&D game where, like, a GM, I didn't know him personally, and he made, like, these awful kind of pigeon-speaking kobolds, and I just was, like, kind of staring at him and thinking, why?
Ooh.
Seriously, dude. So I was like, no, kobolds, they need some, like, they need a little love here. I mean, they're treated like cannon fodder. It's kind of weird. And, like, I didn't know the word at the time, but murder hobo-y? Like, you're just going around, like, killing people and taking their stuff. And I felt like that's kind of jacked up, right? So I wrote about kobolds who are, like they had little character cards, and they had kind of little stats on them. I still didn't, like, the stats were just terrible. But they would get, like, little pieces, and they would make traps out of their cards and place them in a dungeon, and then there would be heroes that would be running through the dungeon. And, like, let's just say the systems weren't really that great. But it was a fun concept, and it got me into... So there's, like, art critique, there's design critique that you get, in especially in a design technology program. But, like playtesting critique could be... it's interesting. And I find that as I've tested more, I designed more, it's been something that I've been very, very... interested in cultivating, and also creating an environment where people can look at something and focus in on critique and talk about a concept or a game mechanic in a way that is shareable and something that someone can learn from. So I get my little, like, teacher hat on when I start talking about it. But it definitely gave me a lot of courage to later develop, like, Companion's Tale, which came out, I guess I developed that a year later. Yeah, maybe? Maybe not. Maybe it was 2 years later.
Either way, hearing about Kobold Engineer makes a lot more sense, because before I was playing Companion's Tale and being like, this is somebody's first game? How is this somebody's first game? It doesn't make any fucking sense. So it really really just restores my faith that you are a regular mortal human. that if you've actually made a bunch of other games that I just never got exposed to. Because I think some people get this idea that, like, if I'm going to make a game, it has to be the next Dungeons and Dragons, or else it's a failure, you know? Like, there's people really put a lot of pressure on themselves when they make a game.
Oh my gosh. The way I see it, because so during the day, I'm like a user experience designer. So I'm always designing something, and it has to plug into something else, and people need to be able to use it. And then not just user experience designers, but I think many designers, whatever you make, it's just it's a part of something bigger. It's a part of something that's, I guess, more enduring, just things that you, if a drop down I want to make doesn't come out the way I want it to, or maybe I have to make compromises on it, or it's such that I can't really say that it's all mine. That's okay, because you're going to design something tomorrow. It's, I guess my philosophy is just very much like, go for it, do it, do the best you can. But eventually you have to look at it and decide, am I, like, how hard do I sweat this? How important is it for this to move forward? Especially for game design, you have, like, you have multiple systems you're designing. I think that when it comes down to designing something, you want to make sure you're hitting your audience, you're hitting, like, what type of message you want to get across really hard, if there's some message attached to it. But also that your systems are doing what they're designed to do. And if there's emergent play, then you can learn from it and pivot from that. And I really, like, I think those are all very valuable things. But also sometimes you just need to pack something up and stick it on a shelf for, like, a few months so that until you can come back to it. Like, I wrote Companion's Tale in August 2013. Significant because I just got married. That's probably the reason why I can remember exactly when it was written. But I wrote it, and I went to Metatopia, and it iterated so fast there. Like, just every single session, there was a change, there was growth. I talked to people, I took notes. And at that one in particular, I developed, like, a style of taking notes just so that I could capture the environment and what people were reacting to, what they were seeing, what I noticed. So that it's not just so-and-so said X. It's like, hey, so-and-so's been a little bit disengaged for a while. They're doing this thing. This other person did something else. Oh, I notice that someone's furrowing their brow at reading a particular description. And, you know, just kind of taking in the mood of the room. And also, I drew these little pictures. There's like an imaginary funerals article that shows like a screenshot of it. But it's there's a ton of like, I made a little iconography set for what I wanted to do based off of what I heard. And then I would summarize everything at the end. Because like, it happens really fast, but it's slowly at the same time. Like, because you're waiting, you're holding your breath while something's going. And you don't want to say anything because you don't want to mess it up. Because people are still thinking and are doing. And you're just like, your breath is caught. And then all of a sudden it works. And you're like, I'm glad I didn't intervene. But you're taking notes also. And you're trying to capture everything about that moment in really succinct bites. And sometimes I'll even write proposed edits during that. So that year was so involved, like from Metatopia to Dreamnation. And then, let's see, I think that year it was Maelstrom's first one, so like 2014 or so. And it was just constant churning and going through iterations. And for that game, like I had there was one session that was just like freaking catastrophic. And I learned a lot from it, but I also was like, I'm going to put this game on the shelf for a few minutes and just like breathe and try to like get myself like shaken out. And I took some time because like part of it was like there was some editorial stuff, but also I was just churning changes and improving like every single time I played it. And I played it at these conventions, but then I would come home and invite people to my apartment and would play it. And I think I've had more play tests of this particular game than any game I've designed before. I mean, it's not like I had a lot that I designed before, but like of any of those, more playtests than a lot of stuff that actually goes out, like in terms of user testing. Like, so it's had a lot of attention lavished on it. Now I'm getting to the point where I'm actually art directing now, which is such an exciting time. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. I've been working with an editor who's like the world's most patient editor or human being on the face of the earth. And I was like sick half of last year or so.
But yeah, life.
Yeah, yeah. And it's getting to a point where certain pieces are falling into place. Like, we're actually talking marketing. I didn't expect I would be talking in a very serious way. Yeah. Because before I was like, oh, okay. In the first year I made it, I was like, oh, we're going to totally get this out to market. 2014. And it didn't work the way I expected. But the extra time, I've put a lot more polish into the game. I think that all of the character roles are so much sharper, so much more well put together. As a designer, I've grown, which has really iterated into the game. And I even took a little bit of time off. Oh yeah, fall of 2014, when I was just like taking a little bit of a break from the game. I wrote another one. It was I would say it's like a Monster Hearts hack, like spiritually. It's about dreaming and about people who have to manage their dreaming life and their waking life and just like the demands of that. And I'm really excited. Like that one is what I'm either working on that one or like a space drama one next.
Oh man, dreaming and Monster Hearts is like a really, really winning combination in my eyes. I would love to play a game like that. That's awesome. So Companion's Tale has been a long time in development and like in the best way, like just sanding down all those edges. I love it. And it'll be very exciting, hopefully sometime this year when we get to see it on Kickstarter.
Yes. Yes.
2016. That is the year we are currently in, 2016. I was wondering if you could just, for our listeners, if you wouldn't mind just giving a quick pitch about what Companion's Tale is all about.
Yeah, sure thing. So, Companion's Tale, it's a map-making story game. And what I mean by that is it's a four-player game where what you're doing is you're creating the entire world that you're playing in. So your map becomes an artifact, and you use it to tell stories off of that. So you have this living map, and you have the story of a hero. So this hero goes through a hero's journey. There's three acts of play, and in theory, there's an apex at the end of the third act. But this hero is not a playable character. This hero is actually being created on the table by the four players who play the hero's companions. So you're building the world at the same time as playing a companion who has an adventure with this hero, or an event that takes place with the hero. And that has ripples throughout the gameplay. So you would start off by building your world as a prologue where everyone gets opportunity to build a piece of the world, then put in some historical events, and then Act 1 begins. There are four roles. There's a cartographer. This person has the ultimate say in terms of what's drawn. They interpret what the other players say during other people's turns, and because of their interpretation, it gives you kind of a living memory of what was said or how it was interpreted. But then the companion is selected from a set of companion cards, and it describes your relationship to the hero. Maybe you're the mentor, or the lover, or the nemesis, and also, you choose themes. What type of story you're going to tell with the hero? Is it going to be a story of conquest? Is it going to be a story of tragedy? And the last thing you choose, and the thing I'm art directing at the moment, is your face. So you might be the love of the hero, but your face is the last thing that's chosen, which in a way informs who you are, but at the same time informs the hero, because the hero and you have this particular relationship, and the circumstances of who the companion is changes based on like what face you select, right? So I really love the look of surprise, and it's kind of exciting, right? Because you don't know who the lover will be, you don't know who the nemesis will be, and it's not going to be the people that you automatically assume, because the face card's last card. So you tell your story about yourself and the hero. The cartographer documents this. Then there's a witness. And the witness looks on the map, and they look elsewhere. They go, what else is going on in this world? Maybe there's an event that was mentioned by someone at the beginning when you add history. And they say, well, this event over here, this is the next thing that happens. So it's just a nudge. And in a way, it kind of helps the world stay alive, right? There's things going on outside of the hero. It's always weird when you read a book and everything's around the hero, absolutely everything. Like a cow can't moo without it somehow being involved with the hero. And then last is the lore keeper. So I am a huge advocate of culture, and culture is a lot of things. So they add a bit of culture based off of events that are happening. So the lore keeper would be listening and kind of looking around the map, and maybe they'll say, oh, a song erupted out of this, or a bit of slang. Oh God, I love it when a good bit of slang just takes hold and people actually use it later on in the game. Oh. At one of the playtests, Michael Miller, he's my editor. He was playing, and I think he came up with this really like funny bit of slang, and it was something that left the table, and people like said it later. And I think almost all of the playtests are my favorite, but oh my gosh, that was so much fun.
It was when I played it with the rest of the one shot crew, our culture turns, we came up with like, here's what people are listening to. Here's what people are dancing. This is how people are dancing now these days. This is a weird word that they've come up with. It's a new insult that just has just yes. appeared in the culture. It's really interesting what people come up with, for sure.
Yeah, and it's so much fun. And it's like when you're telling the story, it can be kind of heavy, right? Mm-hmm. Usually there's a part of, not to get into like the kind of crunchy bits, just to reveal a little bit of how the sausage is made. When I was designing it, there's a prologue that's designed so that there's going to be some type of conflict just from the get-go. Mm-hmm. And often those points of conflict keep pushing against each other. And it's often the source of the huge conflict that the hero needs to resolve. But not all the time. Sometimes things are emerge. At one point in one of the games I was playing, some island appeared out of the mist. And that was the source of, like, I think, resolution in that particular game, but also conflict. And so I really like how each game is so wildly different, and often people will bring in levity when they need to. So you can have a game where you laugh and where you're like, things are very serious and you could be heroic. You have options to be heroic, or you could be a little bit of a villain. There's a nemesis and there's a rival. And oh my gosh. Okay. So another one of my favorite games, there was a figure that emerged in play. Like someone said, oh, there's this woman that was seen with the wolves, and she kind of kept appearing. And I think one of my favorite parts was then when the companion cards came up and it was Outsider. And someone was like, oh, and the Outsider card says, you're not from around here. And the woman that was seen with the wolves, someone by chance drew a woman's card and she seems kind of mysterious and said, I was with the wolves. And I was like, oh! The entire table just gasped. And it was so fantastic because they were just seeing a character that was just like some outside character, just a person that happens in passing, become an actual companion was incredible. And that was so much fun. And I love seeing that happen in play. So each person gets to tell a story as a companion in the first, second, and third act. So these roles rotate. So if you're a cartographer, you're only cartographer while everyone else is talking for that first round, and then everything rotates. And after everyone's had a chance, everyone has their companion in front of them. You get to be biographers, and you get to choose someone's companion that isn't your own, and it'd say something, maybe something gossipy, maybe something totally not true.
Yeah, I love these rounds, the sass rounds.
They really are. Like, it's so much fun. Sometimes in play, they become kind of like a gossip circle. Sometimes it's more TMZ-like, where people are just like shooting out bits of gossip about each other. And the kind of fun thing about it is that one particular phase of play is very malleable. Like, sometimes people will actually speak in the voice of their companion and talk trash about someone else, which that's really cool. Like, for gameplay, I mean I love each piece of it, but that was one of the latter parts of gameplay that was added, because beforehand it was very serious stories, very serious things happening, but that one really added kind of like a release valve, so that when you go into act two or go into act three, you've had a chance to just kind of decompress. So you'd play act two and act three. Act two, you collect another companion. And act three, now you've got two companions in front of you. You reshuffle all the themes used before, so there's reoccurring themes. And you use the companions that you have. You could use one or the other for the third act. And after that, you do your last biographer round, and you do epilogues. And this is a chance for you to have your companions say goodbye to the world. And they talk about their last time that they saw or were with the hero. With that, it's really a great opportunity, because the hero is very important, of course. The stories, you know, you're telling stories about the hero, right? But it's a last chance for the companions to say, this is who I am, this is who I was when I saw the hero last. I'm not saying that my life is, you know, things are, and it's an opportunity for you to say, you know, I have a life outside this person. I am a fully actualized person. And I really, it's like a nice way to end, because I don't think it should end with just the hero saves the day. I think one of the games, like one of the earlier games when I was still hammering out a lot of the rules, it was really cool seeing like the hero just kind of like take the hand of like his greatest rival, and they ascended into the sky, and that was really cool and very powerful ending. At the same time, I was like, how can I make this more companion centric, you know?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, the whole game really feels to me like it's kind of about getting to hear from people who are not normally in the spotlight.
Yes, absolutely.
That intention comes across really well. I mean, and I feel like, pardon me for assuming, that is like a broader statement about storytelling and about gaming as well.
Yeah. Well, yes, definitely. I think a big part of this, like, I've been interested in seeing just a wider range of who gets to tell a story, who gets to be important, but also, so when I was sitting around in art school, you take a ton of freaking critical theory classes. Like, I think I spent more time writing papers than I did in studio. So you don't spend all your time just identifying art. You spend, like, part of the time you spend talking about it in context of when it was made, what type of outside influences were there, with this type of work, why is it made? Who commissioned it? What was it like for our artists to work in this time? What political actions were going on? What literature was going on? So a lot of this influences how I see world development. And if you're going to make a world, all this stuff is interconnected. If someone's writing revolutionary poems, at some point, someone's going to make revolutionary art. If there are things happening, there's going to be something that comes out of it. So seeing all these interwoven effects, I really wanted to make sure that this world was living and everything kind of had an impact. But also, I really said to myself, one single viewpoint is not enough, because there's so many different viewpoints, there's so many different life experiences. It doesn't make sense for me to just say, like, to have it from the point of view of one hero who is the center of everything. Instead, it's from all these other viewpoints and perspectives. And I really hammered it home with, I wrote like a series of principles. Like, these are the guiding principles for this game. I might even go back and say something even stronger. Like, these, I'm not saying these are rules, but these are kind of rules, guys. and one of them is that you don't have to seek consensus. Consensus is not what we're looking for. So at the beginning, during the prologue, when you're answering questions, you're answering the question, not the table. You don't need to agree on it. You don't need to vote on this. It's all about you having a voice and having an explicit voice. And that keeps happening because you can make something up in the biographer's round and you don't have to take it as a fact. You could choose to take it as a fact. Like, oh, actually, you're right. My mother really was a merman. And that's why I've got flippers. And you just take it in, right? But yeah. Or you could just say, that is a slanderous lie. I don't know what you're talking about. Don't you know my mother was really a blue whale? Just as an example. And it's one of those things where I want players to be empowered to say, it's, well, first of all, everyone gets a turn to have their say. But more importantly, you're not being stepped on. But in exchange, when you get to choose your companion, you don't have control over your face. And it's like the birth of your companion, right? You're born the way you're born. And from there, as players, you kind of embrace this surprise. And in a way, by having to select your which companion you are first, you're not pigeonholing someone based on their appearance or apparent age. Oh my gosh, the very first game. The first game when I was like before, this is even before Metatopia, because there was a working group of designers that we got together at John Stavopoulos' house, and we were sitting there and working on creative projects, and I was like, oh, look, can we just play? It's like, in the game was barely a scrap of anything, right? And he drew, so he drew the lover, so he took a card, and he drew this old woman, and we're not talking about, like, old, like, as in senior citizen, we're talking about, like, super elder, and this was the lover of the hero, and I paused for a moment, I was like, oh my gosh, what's gonna happen? I didn't think about anything to kind of encourage people to, you know, just take the face, just accept it. And he just dove in, and he told the most, like, loving story about the two lovers who are separated by an unjust law involving, oh my gosh, I can't even do it justice. It's just, it was like, I was just, like, struck by it and just kind of amazed. And I'm like, okay, I have to definitely pack this up. I have to take him to Metatopia. I have to see if something comes out of this, because he had just this wonderful little story that I still just, like, it stays with me, and I'm like, yes, this is what I want to have happen. And I invite, and I really hope that other players will, you know, take a chance and take a risk on something unknown like that. I know it can be, because, like, when you make a character, usually you I customize the heck out of my characters. When I'm playing a tabletop, I'm like doing all the widgets, I'm like, they're like this and like that. So to give up that type of control, I'd be really grateful for players who do that, because I think it's the one area where I'm like, this is this is where you don't necessarily have a say over which is the appearance of your companion.
Well, it kind of reminds me, in terms of mechanics that I love, because it is something that I love, it reminds me of the turn someone on role in Monster Hearts. And that's like a really, really central move. And there's this whole thing where your character just gets turned on by this character, and you might have had an idea about who your character is or isn't attracted to, but you have to give that up. And I think it is hard for some players to kind of adjust to, but at the same time, it makes this beautiful, beautiful statement about like, what's it like to have no control over who you're attracted to? Sounds a little bit like real life, actually.
Yes, and I really, oh God, I love Monster Hearts so much. Yeah, so I feel that. It just I that's the one area that I ask people to give up control, but in the rest of it I feel like it's you're really free to express yourself, and that's so important to me. I guess I just really like, there's been times at the table where I felt like, man, I really would like to say something or I'd like to do something, and it's, I guess guaranteeing it became so important. It just was like, it has to be enshrined in the game. Everyone will get a turn.
Yeah, no, and it's I'm someone who likes really structured games, and I really enjoyed the structuring of the three acts and of each turn, you know, within each act. You know, you talked a little bit earlier about, does your game make a statement? Are you making the statement you want to with this game? And this game is saying everyone's truth deserves to be heard. Even if it conflicts with other people's truth, it deserves to be out there. I hope that was intentional. Yes. Judging by your facial expression, I'm not totally off.
Absolutely. I like, when you get down to it, there's a lot of perspectives aren't necessarily represented. And I really want that to change. And I feel like I'm in a position where I can make games that are like, guess what? There's going to be more perspectives.
I love it. So we mentioned that designing Companion's Tale has been a very long process. I was wondering, what about that process has been for you the most challenging?
Oh, man. I think editing. Because at a certain point, like, and this is within the first year of it being made, a lot of, I would say 85% of the game was there. But deciding what to edit, what to change, I'd spend a lot of time going through the feedback, going through how it felt, seeing if I could push the game to be larger, playing it like smaller. Just a lot of it's been a lot of stretching and just kind of a lot of it's just editing, like hard editing. Like in the end, oh my gosh, I think I like yelped for joy when Cole Miller said he would edit with me. Like, seriously, it was just, it's been one of the hardest parts. I think that, like, honestly for me, because it's when you're facilitating a game, like, there's a lot that you say or do that are very natural, that like you'll take a note or something, but then you might say something offhand and not realize it was important. But thankfully I've had like some amazing people who would play the game more than one time and hear me talk about it or hear me do my opening spiel of how to play a game, and would remind me, like, for instance, Avanel Wing, she like say, Laura, you know, you keep saying this hero's a cipher. Maybe you should encode that into like the actual rules, like formally. And I'm like, oh yes. And there's other people, like, where they've played it and they point things out, like, hey, remember this thing that you say or this thing that you used to do? Or, oh, you've changed this. I like this better this way. And, I mean, it's nice because I find that people in this particular community, and having a community of practice is so important. Oh, my God. Like, having other people who are excited, enthusiastic to support your work, and willing and patient. Oh, my gosh. Like, I'm so grateful for all the patient people who've played, like, half-baked game ideas I had. And having just, like, people that are playing but also wanting to play is so important, because I wouldn't have gotten this far without them. So I'm really, really, like, indebted to this community in so many ways.
I was going to ask, what has been the best part or the biggest help to you during this process? And it sounds like it's been the community.
Yes. Like, yes, definitely. Like, people who are willing to hear me bounce ideas or give me advice or just simply play. Honestly, so you would think New York is a huge art scene, but like I had a lot of trouble finding the right niche for myself. So around the time where I'm becoming UX designer, I'm like, I'm not going to rent a studio. Screw this noise. I'm going to pack all my like physical computing and projector type stuff away. And also game design, you could do it on the train. You could do it anywhere. So it's kind of, I gotta say, in terms of ease of access and barrier reducing, doing independent game design is kind of there. It's not even kind of, it's there. Because only recently have I had like enough financial stability that I'm like, oh, I could go places. I could do things. I could front money for like going to like a weekend away to do playtesting. So being able to do something where the amount of investment I need to put in was lower is an incredible part of being able to spend time making mistakes, learning from it, iterating to get to a point where I have a game that's feeling pretty polished. So I definitely, like, it's the people, but also it's so accessible, which I really would like, if I had a mission statement, it would be to kind of bring that to more people. Because there's just, it's a fun community, it's a fun hobby. There's a lot of perception about who's a gamer and who's not. So as I think just about everyone's a gamer, I mean, unless you absolutely say I hate playing games of all kinds, no matter what.
Yeah, I hear you. My grandmother plays Bridge.
My mom's really good at solitaire, like seriously. Like, I would sit there and watch her play. She's like a machine. It's kind of crazy. I have deep respect of her solitaire game and all the variations she plays. But yeah, like it's so more accessible than a lot of other things I've been doing. So I think that's been a big part of what made it easy to stay and be creative and productive as a designer. And I think it's just, it's getting better. Like there's more and more people out there talking and being available and networking in the non kind of boring corporate way.
Yeah, yeah. Networking, like, except you actually like the people you're talking to.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, actually, that leads me into my last question, which is, if you encountered someone who was working on their first game, what would your advice to them be? What would you say to them?
Oh my gosh. I think I would, I guess I'd start with something like, when you're getting, like, give yourself, I'd say, a good 30 minutes before your game starts. And you want to first find out where you're going. Second, kind of come up with key things that you want to test. Things that you like, that you want to know about the game. Things that if you knew about them, you'd be able to like make changes or think about. That way your mind's a little bit organized. And I was testing the game about dreaming, and I was nervous. I was really nervous because this was the first playtest since Maelstrom. I was really like just feeling out of sorts. And I was talking to John Safopoulos, and he came and he was like, Laura, because usually in my life, I'm very good at setting boundaries. So he was like, set a boundary, like of what you want people to tell you about the game. It's not like what you want them to say, but more of, like, I'm playtesting a game, it's in this state. So, you know, you could tell them, oh, it's in really alpha, or I just brainstorming, or like, hey, this is in beta test, I've got a couple systems finished, I'm looking for feedback on maybe how this works, or how onboarding works, how this fight mechanic works. Just try to be specific about what you're looking for, and then tell them the format. Hey, what I'm going to do is in my style, so I observe it. Everyone while they're playing. So tell them how you want to get feedback. Okay, so we're going to do 1 hour of gameplay. This could be a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back for another half hour, and then we'll do feedback. So if you have any feedback, please just hold on to it, and we'll go over it at the end. And then from there, hydrate. You want to be hydrated, like legit hydrated. When you're dehydrated, you feel worse. So like if you hydrate, first of all, it helps you keep your cool. So no one knows how nervous you are. And then second, you don't feel like crap later on or during.
I love this. I love this advice, actually. Set boundaries, ask for specific, you know, feedback, and drink some water.
Yeah. Like you'll feel so much better later on.
Well, I say we ended on that note. I think that's a really nice high point. It's been lovely chatting with you. Is there anywhere that our listeners can reach you or find out what you're up to, on Twitter or something?
Yeah, I'm always tweeting. So my handle on Twitter is LabMouse. So it's at LabMouse, you know, kind of like the opposite of a lab rat. I mentioned how I married this guy, Dev Percasta. So I had an imprint, Little Octopus. He had an imprint for Great Justice Games. There we go. Yes. So we've had, like, so we were working under separate imprints. We're combining them under Sweet Potato Press right now.
Oh, that's awesome. Sweet Potato Press. Is there like a sweetpotatopress.com?
There is a sweetpotatopress.com. Yeah, we're combining, and it's very exciting. It's like getting your game imprints married. So it's like space and like sad princesses and heroes and dreams. So it's kind of, hopefully it's magical.
It's all the good stuff.
Yeah, it's going to be something. So that's happening right now. We're just kind of merging.
All right, sounds delicious. Big thanks to Laura for coming on the show. And as always, thank you heroes for listening. Tune in next time where I'll be talking to LARPwright and academic Sarah Lynn Bowman. As many of you know, I love hearing people's thoughts on the show. So if you want to get in touch, don't hesitate. You can send an email to backstorypodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Google+, that's Backstory Podcast. Or you can tweet at me at BackstoryCast. Oh, and if you use iTunes, rate the show or leave a review. There have been a few reviews so far and they're really cute. I like them. And as always, Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. You can go to oneshotpodcast.com to find more great shows like One Shot, Campaign, Modifier, and Talking Tabletop. That sweet tune you're hearing now is called Thinking of You by Ujiko. You can find more of their work at soundcloud.com/Ujiko. Talk to you later, heroes.